Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday, the 25th of October, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 56 in our series here, where we look at white contributions to civilization. And for the last dozen or so episodes, we've been particularly looking at British history, unearthing lots of British history that a lot of people are completely unaware of. And we have with us today a patriarch from the patriotic arts community, and we also have Truthvids from truthvids.net, who has now joined us as a permanent host. Patriarch, how are you doing, sir?
Hi, Sven. Yeah, I'm very well, thanks.
Good to hear. Truthvids, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
All good. Thanks, Sven. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff, great stuff. Last week we got on to, or in the last episode rather, we got on to talking about Augustine of Canterbury. So we're going to continue with that today, and we're going to look at what R.W. Morgan has to say about Augustine, which is not particularly flattering, of course, because he's coming from a Welsh nationalist viewpoint, and that's the way that histories were written 150 years ago. They were extremely patriotic, even chauvinistic, you could say. And we're also going to take a look at what Wikipedia then has to say about the same events, and also about Augustine. So we will start with Wikipedia and their description of Augustine. They say, Augustine of Canterbury was a monk who became the first Archbishop of Canterbury in the year 597. He is considered the apostle to the English and a founder of the English Church. Augustine was the prior of a monastery in Rome when Pope Gregory the Great chose him in 595 to lead a mission, usually known as the Gregorian Mission, to Britain to Christianize King Ethelbert and his Kingdom of Kent from Anglo-Saxon paganism. And again, we'll just stop there, because he's known as the apostle to the English, but in actual fact, the English were Christianized mainly by Irish prelates and Welsh prelates, missionaries. Columba was one of them, and we'll get into all of that. We'll also get into just what this Anglo-Saxon paganism was in a minute. But first, I'll just pass it over to Truthvids. Any comments that you want to make about Augustine of Canterbury before we move further into this?
Yeah, it just shows you that they really tried to hide the fact that the British were already Christian, and probably also, you know, Ireland as well. They must have had Christians, and they're trying to rewrite history that the Catholic Church saved the world, essentially, right? And turned everyone Christian, and without the Catholic Church, we wouldn't have Christianity, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of politics that is at play here in trying to cover up the fact that the British Church had precedence before the Church of Rome. It was actually the British Church at Rome. It was the Palatium Britannicum, which was used as the first church at Rome. And of course, the British Christians, they became a Christian nation around about 150 AD under King Lucius. And it wasn't for another 150, 200 years before Rome actually pronounced herself Christian. And that's what the records tell us. I mean, people writing, I think in the third or the fourth century, were saying that the first nation to pronounce themselves Christian was Britain. And Christianity that made its way into Britain made its way in during the reign of Tiberius, which can only have been Joseph of Arimathea at that particular time. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I just think they obviously only saw their own faith or set of doctrines as Christian. So, you know, they just label it that way. And that's it. They probably just thought of everything else as somewhat pagan.
Well, yeah, that is one way that they could have looked at it. And it was their traditions and their dogma that they thought was all important. If you look at Augustine's letters, he's really, really het up about Easter. And in Ireland, they had Easter on a different date. And in Britain, they had Easter on a different date. And he's absolutely incensed by this and sends off loads of letters, like all about the correct date of Easter. And if that's all he had to worry about, that was all that they really had that was different, then, you know, there really can't have been that much difference if all it was a date. But we do know there was also the fact that the Welsh or the Britons didn't baptize, and he wasn't very happy about that either. But we'll get into all of that as we work our way through here. And as I was reading this this Wikipedia bit on Augustine, and it says that he was sent to Britain to Christianize King Ethelbert and his kingdom of Kent from Anglo-Saxon paganism. I thought we'd have a look at what Wikipedia has to say about Anglo-Saxon paganism, because some of our pagan listeners may be quite surprised at this. And they say, the pre-Christian society of Anglo-Saxon England was illiterate. Thus, there is no contemporary written evidence produced by Anglo-Saxon pagans themselves. There is some evidence for the existence of timber temples, although other cultic spaces might have been open air and would have included cultic trees and megaliths. Now, they also say that the ancient Britons were illiterate. We know that the ancient Britons weren't illiterate. They had the Colburn alphabet. The Saxons probably had runes, but nothing was actually written in these runes that we could work out what their beliefs were today. And what really interests me about this, it says that there is some evidence for the existence of timber temples. So these Anglo-Saxon pagans, all they did was build sheds. And what you had before that, you had the Druids, who became Christians, and obviously they put up these great megalithic structures. They put up stone circles, they put up dolmens, they put up burial chambers. But the Anglo-Saxons, all they were capable of doing is putting up sheds. And we've got no evidence for these sheds today. And Anglo-Saxon England was pagan for all of about 200 years, 300 years. That's it. So anybody British today that claims to be following ancient British paganism or ancient English paganism, what they're basically saying is that they're following an innovation that was brought into the country and lasted for only 200 or 300 years, didn't actually leave any written evidence of it, so we have no idea exactly what it was that they were worshipping. And all the great peak of their glorious history was that they were able to build wooden sheds. I mean, they weren't even able to put stones up into a dolmen like the ancient Britons were before then. I think it's a bit of a sad indictment, to be honest, of Anglo-Saxons, that was all that they left for us. Perhaps I'm a little bit biased here because I'm half Welsh. Truthvid, what are your thoughts on this and the great history of shed building of the pagans?
Yeah, well, I would just say that, obviously the imported Israelites had lost everything. So they're just these wandering migrants, right? So everything was just living in, on wheels or horses, basically, and with your flock. So they didn't really start building permanent structures until, they eventually settled. But as for paganism, there is some evidence by looking at the days of the week, what gods they had. If you look at the names, Tuesday is after the god Tyr day, Wednesday is Woden day, Thursday is Thor day, Friday is Frigg or Freya, that's Odin's wife. And then they must have kept some of the Roman pagan days, because Saturday is Saturn day, and then Sunday would be the sun in the sky, and Monday would be the moon day. So this also shows that the Catholic Church were always willing to capitulate, right? They would always adopt paganism into their, quote unquote Christian religion, if that country and nation would allow the Pope to rule over them. That's all that mattered. And we see all of Europe accepted these days, right? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, which are clearly pagan days. But as long as they were ruled over by the Pope didn't mind, right?
So it was just pretty much being pragmatic about things and wanting to bring as many people in as possible into Christendom and the Commonwealth. I think you make a good point there about how this ties in with this understanding of history, that the ancient European nations had their origins in these 10 tribes of Israel and the 2 tribes of Judah that were deported from their lands and put into Assyria. And of course, because they were sort of kicked out from their civilization, they wouldn't have had a civilization with them, yet they would have had the knowledge of how to do that. And that's pretty much what we see with these Anglo-Saxons. They didn't have a history. They just suddenly appear in Europe, and they're warriors. They're seen as barbarians, but they're obviously white people. They've obviously got a high IQ. So where is the civilization that they built? Why is there no evidence of one in Europe? Well, that's because they made their way into Europe and their civilization was the one that was in the Near East, and they'd been removed from that whole area. So I think, you know, what you're saying there about this explains why they were illiterate, why they were just building sheds, or why there was only the evidence of sheds. That's the reason why, because they had lost everything. They'd lost all the trappings of civilization. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense that as a people, they were so used to just constantly migrating and moving that they obviously lost touch with how to build. And so, yeah, that's why it got broken down, or, you know, or that, or it was just testament to the strength of other cultures able to dominate it. But I do wonder, though, with the paganism, was that strictly just the kind of the Nordic paganism? Because it seems quite similar to a lot of the ancient Greek sort of personification of gods like Zeus and the like. Is it just a deviation of that?
Well, we're not really sure. I mean, we know that, I mean, from when we looked at Odin, we know that around about that area, they saw that they were descended from Odin, or their aristocracy was. And we see that the Anglo-Saxon kings, that was where they claimed the right to rule from, was the fact that they were descended from Odin. So we can see that these Odinic beliefs were probably a part of it, and especially with the Woden as being Wednesday. So, you know, we can say that. That we know that much, but we don't really know much details. And also, in order to have scribes writing down histories, I mean, you have to have a settled civilization with food being brought in for the intellectuals. You have to have a farming area outside. You have to have roads that are then going to take the food in, so that the intellectuals' types can spend their time doing their intellectualizing. You have to have the whole system of people working together, and it has to be centralized, a central bureaucracy, and it needs to, you know, sort of lots and lots of people that have been living in one area for quite a period of time. You have to have all of that, you know, before you can have people writing this stuff down, I think. So that, again, that explains why they didn't leave any written records, although they did have this runic alphabet. There is no evidence that anyone living in Anglo-Saxon England ever described themselves as a pagan, or understood there to be a singular religion of paganism that stood as a monolithic alternative to Christianity. These pagan belief systems would have been inseparable from other aspects of daily life. According to the archaeologists Martin Carver, Alex Sandmark, and Sarah Semple, Anglo-Saxon paganism was not a religion with supra-regional rules and institutions, but a loose term for a variety of local intellectual world views. Carver stressed that in Anglo-Saxon England, neither paganism nor Christianity represented homogeneous intellectual positions or canons and practices. Instead, there was considerable interdigitation between the two. As a phenomenon, this belief system lacked any apparent rules or consistency and exhibited both regional and chronological variation. The archaeologist Alex Pluskowski suggested that it is possible to talk of multiple Anglo-Saxon paganisms. So basically what we're talking about here is a philosophy that a tribe had to explain the world. And because we had a multiplicity of tribes, we had the Jutes, the Angles, and the Saxons, each one would have had their own understanding of the world. I'm not sure that they even had priests, like the Druids were priests. I mean, don't forget, in Britain, you had this overarching system of Druidry, and you also had that in Gaul, and that had a long history in Europe. But this idea of Odinism and this paganism, well, we call it paganism, we don't know what the Anglo-Saxons actually called it, that was very different, and it was also very new. So I think maybe it's more similar to like the Red Indians of America, that had their different beliefs, and they had their own different tribal gods. And, you know, there may have been that here. Maybe the different Saxon tribes had their own, you know, they had their own history, and they probably would have deified their ancient kings, and it would have all been slightly different. This is why it's so ridiculous to call yourself a pagan today and claim to be going back to, you know, the authentic white religion, because it just wasn't like that. I mean, our whole ideas of what a religion is today is shaped by what religion has become today. And what we had back then was just a philosophy of life. an understanding of how life worked, and that evolved into Christianity. Christianity was obviously superior to their understanding before they became Christian, or they wouldn't have accepted it, and they wouldn't have become Christian. True Vids.
Sven, can I just add? We already covered like Odin and Freya, but the other gods are really interesting. Because if you look in the prophet Isaiah, he said that when the Israelites were deported, he promised that in the future the Leviathan would be tossed into the sea, right? And if you don't understand that, that just sounds crazy, right? But if you realize, you know, the Leviathan is talking about the Edomites, and that the sea is all the other people, that it's basically telling you the future of Europe becoming Christian, and those people gradually got kicked out of Europe, and then they amassed, you know, all the world out there and got them to swarm into Europe. It's basically telling you the future. And when you read like the pagan history, for the Son of God would one day at the end return and fight this great Leviathan, right? That would be encircling and strangling us, basically, the Europeans. That's what the Europeans believed, if you read this myth. And that's exactly what it tells you in Revelation, right? And as for the god Tyr, he gave up his right hand. It was eaten by the wolf, which was Fenrir, and Fenrir was descended from Loki. And in old Latin, Lucifer would actually be Lucifer, right? And it's so obvious, Loki, Lucifer, it's just a shortening of the name that the Goths were, they must have been influenced by the, you know, the Christian religion, and they got these stories and wove it into their myths. So it was there. And, you know, allegorically, Christ described himself as the right hand of God, because whenever you do something, you know, if you write a letter, you use your right hand. If you work, you use your right hand. Your right hand's basically doing your will. So allegorically, Christ is, you know, God on earth fulfilling his will. So his right hand. And the myth of Tyr was that he gave up his right hand and it was devoured by wolves. And the purpose of that was to save the world, right? That's the myth. And allegorically, God gave up his right hand, Christ. And his proponents during his ministry were described as wolves, and they killed him, right? So he allegorically gave up his hand to save the world. So there's a lot of these pagan myths. If you realize what they're talking about, they are so close to Christianity, right? That the serpent would be thrown out into the ocean, and then it would come back at the end of days to surround us, and then four would return to slay it. That is Christianity, right? I just wanted to add that because we haven't covered those two gods, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting stuff. I think when it also talks about giants in the Old Testament, you think of the power that giants have, and then you think of tech giants today, and the way that you know, they have an influence on all of our lives. It's huge tech giants, and it, you know, it's just the idea that there were giants in the past that were similar to that. But you know, perhaps that is. Allegorically, that's what it's referring to, as things, you know, sort of tend to repeat themselves throughout history, and we get these cryptic messages throughout the Bible. And I think also here, I mean, it says here, doesn't it, there was considerable interdigitation between the two, between Christianity and what we call today paganism, and that's what you're explaining there, I think. Truth Vids Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, there's been parallels, obviously, since even the ancient Greek gods, which are similar, the personification and deifying of man, and worshipping them. I mean, Paul talks about it at the beginning of Romans, how they gave up the God of, you know, the one true God, to essentially worship man. And he was talking to the Romans who did that, who did once know God because they were of Israel. and yeah, there's definitely a correlation I see between these types. And, you know, I think it was, we've discussed it before, and I know Truth Vids talks a lot about this, but the offshoot of Dada and from the line of Judah who went on to begin the foundings of, you know, the Greek gods, and almost deifying their worship, and it kind of started this new world almost. And I think that's where a lot of the cultural religion started.
I think we can see a difference as well between what the Druids believed, and they had one overarching god, and one of the names for God was Yesu, which is the same name that the Christians used for Jesus, and the links that they had with the Levites and how the priesthood was hereditary, and that was the old religion of Europe. And then you've got this new religion that comes in, which probably has more in common with sort of Canaanite beliefs and the syncretistic paganism of these other tribes that were around in the Near East. So you get these ideas of Esther or Astarte, where we get the word Easter from, and you get Baal, whose name appears in Beltane, which is the May Day festival. And these were like newer ideas that came in from the Near East with these tribes of Israel when they made their way in. But before that, what you had in, I think, in Britain particularly was this Druidic religion with these flamens. And they mocked the Romans for believing that Caesar was a god. You know, their idea of God was, it was not a man. It was the creative force and the creator. So you can see that you know, you've got two different ideas there, and the newer idea is the one with lots of different gods, which obviously came in from the Near East, I think, with these 10 tribes of Israel that then became the European nations. Based on the evidence available, the historian John Blair stated that the pre-Christian religion of Anglo-Saxon England largely resembled that of the pagan Britons under Roman rule, at least in its outward forms. Well, what pagan Britons? The Britons had been Christian since 150 AD. However, the archaeologist Audrey Meaney concluded that there exists very little undoubted evidence for Anglo-Saxon paganism, and we remain ignorant of many of its essential features of organisation and philosophy. Similarly, the old English specialist Roy Page expressed the view that the surviving evidence was too sparse and too scattered to permit a good understanding of Anglo-Saxon paganism. And I do think a lot of you know, these pagan ideas today, they come from people just imagining what it was going to be like back then, or thinking that they have a vision and an understanding of what paganism was like. That's, you know, what they did with the Wicca beliefs. That's what they did with New Age beliefs. And I think that's, you know, a lot of these pagan beliefs today have their origin in that sort of thing as well. I mean, they're saying here,
isn't pagan though by the standard of its original form, any religion that really wasn't, any worship that wasn't the God of Israel?
Yeah,
anything was regarded as pagan.
Yeah, it was defined as outside of this belief in the God of Israel, outside of the belief of Christianity. So it was defined in opposition to Christianity, basically. But what they're saying here is we've got no details on it. We don't know what it was. We've got no details on it. And the bit that I find surprising is that you know, they say this, the pagan Britons under Roman rule, as if the Romans were Christian and the Britons were pagan, when the truth is it was the opposite way around. And we have original documentation from the time telling us this, and yet the mainstream historians are telling us something different. So I wanted to also bring up some of this rewriting of history that is on Wikipedia when they talk about this. They say, during most of the 4th century, the majority of Britain had been part of the Roman Empire, which started in 380 AD with the Edict of Thessalonica, had Christianity as its official religion. So Christianity was the official religion of Rome from 380 AD onwards, yet Britain was Christian in 150 AD. So Britain had been Christian for 200 years by that point. However, in Britain, Christianity was probably still a minority religion, restricted largely to the urban centres and their hinterlands. Where do they get that from? Probably still a minority religion. We are told that in order to change the religion of the country, there had to be a unanimous vote. And it's Julius Caesar that tells us that. And then we're told that in 150 AD or 170 AD, and I think the difference in times goes on what we talked about the other week that Alan Wilson pointed out about one of those dates goes from the birth of Christ and one of those dates goes to the death and resurrection of Christ. That's why there's a 30-year difference between 150 AD and 170 AD. But Julius Caesar tells us that there had to be a unanimous vote in order to change or to make changes in the matter of the national religion. And then we're told that in 150 AD, 170 AD, Britain became the first nation to become Christian. So that meant there was a unanimous vote. So why do they say here, oh, it's probably still a minority religion? And they're talking about 380 AD here, you know, 200 years after Britain became Christian or the British became Christian. I said largely restricted to the urban centres and their hinterlands. Well, you know, that isn't what the primary source documentation tells us, is it? It says, while it did have some impact in the countryside, here it appears that indigenous late Iron Age polytheistic belief systems continued to be widely practiced. Some areas, such as the Welsh Marches, the majority of Wales, except in Gwent, Lancashire, and the southwestern peninsula, are totally lacking evidence for Christianity in this period. Well, what would they accept as evidence for Christianity? I mean, I don't think you got images of Christ on the cross until like 4th or the 5th century, something like that. And you're not, they weren't building churches in this period. I mean, what they were doing was using the same places that had been sacred to them for 1,000 years or for centuries, and using those same places as worship centres. You know, the change from Druidry to Christianity was a smooth change. It's not like lots of things changed. And again, we're told that as well, because we're told that Christianity was a new thing in the East, but there never was a time when the Britons were not following its precepts, or the Druids were not following its precepts. And I think that's Taliesin the Bard writing in the 6th century that pointed that out. So, you know, they're saying it's totally lacking evidence for Christianity in this period. That's just not true. I mean, even Bede tells us that there was Christianity at this time. And also, when they had this Edict of Thessalonica, you know, we've got a list of the bishops that were there, and there were British bishops that had been sent to it. You know, and it's accepted by the Roman Catholic Church. I think Polydore Virgil, the historian, and he says that Britain has preeminence in Christianity. It was the British church that was the first Christian church. And they got records of British bishops that were sent to all of these councils that they had, all of these church councils. So we have lots of evidence for it. But Wikipedia just tells us that, you know, it's totally lacking evidence for Christianity in this period. So, I mean, they're basically rewriting history there, I think. Truefids, any thoughts?
Yeah, you don't necessarily need to have, you know, giant churches for Christianity. That's not what the apostles, you know, they didn't, when they spread Christianity to Anatolia and Greece, they didn't, you know, in none of their writings are they saying this. They're just saying you just got to gather and preach and become a Christian community. You can just meet outside or in someone's house. It's only much later when it becomes an organized religion that you start to have priests and all that, which really, you don't need any priest in Christianity. Every man should just be the Christian priest of his own household. That's when you started getting all these churches, and, you know, people wanted to feel important, and they become bishops and all that. But just the way they worded it, Iron Age polytheistic beliefs, is they're trying to always make out that Christianity was just a phase of you know, human development. There were hundreds of other religions, and there was just this period where just randomly people believed in Christianity. And that, you know, there's always been many other religions. That's what they're always kind of trying to spin it. But you know, really, there's only ever been one religion, right? And Noah and his sons must have followed something close to Christianity, right? They hadn't yet had Christ come, and then gradually they all went off into paganism. So you get Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and God brings them back to him, and then gradually all the Israelites go off into paganism again, or most of them except Judea. So then Christ comes and brings them all back to him. So there's only ever been one religion and people straying off into paganism, right? So that's the real truth, not this many polytheistic belief systems, but the way they're trying to spin it, right?
Yeah, what is their evidence? for late Iron Age polytheistic belief systems in Britain. They don't have any evidence for that. You know, they haven't found any idols or anything like that. And we've got, ancient Welsh texts, and which are supposedly go all the way back with Druidic beliefs. And if you look at, what they say, there was just one God. And I think he had a form of the future, the past, and the present. And so you actually had a Trinity. And there is a belief that one of the reasons why, the Trinity got absorbed into Christianity, it originated with the Druids. But there's also people that say that it originated with Greek philosophy. Patriarch, any thoughts on what Wikipedia is saying here? I mean, it's basically just trashing our Christian heritage in Britain as being the first Christian nation, I think.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously just skimming the surface on, mainstream information and not digging deep enough or using alternate sources. It's just a classic case of using sources, which paint the narrative of those that want to be painted. But touching on some points mentioned, on a church isn't actually a building at all. It's that's just how we've come to know what a church is, but it's rooted in the word. I think we mentioned earlier it's a ecclesia, isn't it, for the Greek, and that literally just means a gathering of citizens, and it's an assembly of people. So that's essentially what the church is. The church is an assembly of people or Christians. I did some reading on the Edict of Thessalonica, and apparently it's that essentially cemented Christianity as the official religion of Rome. And there's a distinct effort to reinforce the doctrine of the Holy Trinity. So I wonder then if that was their goal, that anything that deviated from that was regarded as pagan. And there were other forms of Christianity before that, such as Arianism, which was founded by a guy called Arius. So I don't think it's rooted in Arian as in, Indo-European or anything, but it's just a guy. And, they had a kind of wavering or different beliefs. There's a quote as well from the Edict of Thessalonica, which says, "They will suffer in the first place the chastisement of the divine condemnation, and in the second, the punishment of our authority that in accordance with the will of heaven, we shall decide to inflict." So, there was obviously, they were on a campaign to just literally wipe out anything that didn't go their way. And I think that's maybe why a lot of the there's not much left of the original Anglo-Saxons, because it was probably destroyed, and there might have been a lot more evidence to suggest Christianity there, but I reckon it was just destroyed by them.
So rather than the Anglo-Saxons, you're saying probably more evidence of the Christian Britons there, but that ended up being destroyed. I think
more than likely, yeah, because I don't know if they embraced the doctrine of the Trinity, because that seemed to be central to Rome.
Yeah, well, what they did, they didn't call these other things like paganism. They called them heresies, because there were different understandings of Christianity, and they wanted there to be like just one Catholic understanding of Christianity united. You know, it's a good motive to have, but maybe the execution of it didn't work out so well. And when you were talking there about the ecclesia, I mean, that's the old Greek word for church, and yet we have places named after that in Wales. You have Eglwysiwrw, and like the word eglwys is from ecclesia, and in Cornwall you have Eglwysgerry, and eglwys again is this Greek word for church. So that is such an old word. For that to now be parts of place names, I mean, that must go back to pre-Roman times, because that goes back to pre-Latin. It goes back to Greek, really, before Latin, that we have these names. So I think there's proof there in the place names that these churches
British. The word church is the German word Kirche or something, and that actually literally means a building. So what they did is, where it says, Paul says, "I went to the ecclesia," meaning the gathering of the people, they mistranslate that to church. And then people read the Bible and think, oh, Paul was going to churches, so we have to have a church. And then where it says I went to the leader, you know, the gatherer, you know, whoever they that ecclesia had nominated, right? So you might say, look, if us three gathered, Sven, you can just organize it, and you'd be the organizer. And they mistranslate it to bishop, so people think, oh wow, there were bishops back then. And then where it says you should vote for who you want to gather, it's raise the hand in Greek. That's what it means. They changed it to, I can't remember the word, the anoint, the designated. It was some official word which makes it sound like the Pope needed to choose. So then, you know, when you read the Bible, it sounds as if Paul's setting up basically this organized church with people he's setting up and designating. And it misleads people, because really it was just communities gathering themselves, organizing themselves, and following Christianity, basically, right?
Yeah, it's also like this, our understanding of saint, you know, that has changed, and now it's somebody, you know, after they've died. And I think back at this time, third and the fourth century, saint was just a holy man. And yeah, and as you were saying there, when the word ecclesia got changed to church, and then or Kirk in German, and then that was referring to the actual buildings. But if we see place names that have the word ecclesia in them, then that must have been before that happened. And it's talking about the gathering of people. So when you find that in Welsh place names and Cornish place names, that must go back to pre-Saxon times. Again, continuing with what Wiki has to say here, Britons who found themselves in the areas now dominated by Anglo-Saxon elites possibly embraced the Anglo-Saxons' pagan religion in order to aid their own self-advancement, just as they adopted other trappings of Anglo-Saxon culture. And I just can't believe that. That has to have been the other way around. You know, it was Christianity that was a part of Rome by this time, and then you had the Franks becoming Christian as well. And you had people that wanted to become Christian because it advanced trade, and it meant that you were a part of this bigger civilization. Much as people want to join the BRICS today, or people want to join NATO today. I mean, it was a similar thing, and yet they're saying it was the other way around. These Britons that had this great tradition and that had civilization and that knew how to read and write, it's saying here, oh no, they didn't. They just wanted to join these illiterate Saxons and follow their religion of following these different gods, when these very same Britons had mocked the Roman gods and this belief of following the Roman gods. And Wiki says this would have been easier for those Britons who, rather than being Christian, continued to practice indigenous polytheistic belief systems. And again, there's no evidence for that. And in areas, this late Iron Age polytheism could have syncretically mixed with the incoming Anglo-Saxon religion. There's no evidence for that at all. Conversely, there is weak possible evidence for limited survival of Roman Christianity into the Anglo-Saxon period, such as the place name Eccles, meaning church, at two locations in Norfolk, and Eccles in Kent. Well, what about the ones that I've pointed out in Wales and the ones in Cornwall? And they're saying that's evidence, weak evidence for the limited survival of Roman Christianity. Well, it's not a Roman word, is it? I mean, these words are Welsh versions and ancient Brittonic versions of the word Eglus, rather than ecclesia. They say, however, Blair suggested that Roman Christianity would not have experienced more than a ghost life in Anglo-Saxon areas. And again, it was British Christianity. There were British bishops that were present at all of these councils before this one in Thessaloniki or whatever it was. Those Britons who continued to practice Christianity were probably perceived as second-class citizens and were unlikely to have had much of an impact on the pagan kings and aristocracy, which was then emphasising Anglo-Saxon culture and defining itself against British culture. Well, why did Alfred the Great have to go to Wales then, asking for a monk to come down from Wales to teach the Saxons how to read and write, and to write Alfred the Great's history? I mean, it just shows you that in Wales, this civilization and Christianity had continued all this time with all these traditions going all the way back before Rome. And so if the British Christians were able to convert any of the Anglo-Saxon elite conquerors, it was likely only on a small community scale, with British Christianity having little impact on the later establishment of Anglo-Saxon Christianity in the 7th century. And that is just absolute rubbish. I mean, the missionaries came over from Ireland, the missionaries came over from Wales. Augustine of Canterbury, he managed to convert the King of Kent, and that was just about it. All the rest of it was done by the bishops from the Britons and the bishops from the Irish, Christianizing the Picts and up in Northumberland as well. And it just you know, it's incredible the way that they rubbish the history here and hide the fact that the British Church was the first church. And also, don't forget that the Welsh are actually fighting against these Saxons at this time as well. You know, why would they want to be converting them? You know, they want their land back. They don't really want to be pushed all the way into Wales and Northumberland and what have you. If you actually look on a map, you've got this Saxon area, which is basically just the southeast of England, and that's it. And the rest of it is all Britons, and then up the top there, you've got the Picts. So I just wanted to bring this up as just an example of Wikipedia changing history, ignoring what the written record is, and just people making a guess. You know, I mean, it's just a guess. Oh, Iron Age polytheism. It could have syncretically mixed with the incoming Anglo-Saxon religion, but that wasn't the case. The Britons were Christian, and they were mocking the Roman religion before then of worshipping all these different gods. So, you know, where does this Iron Age polytheism come from? It's just nonsense, I think. True Foods, any thoughts?
Well, yeah, why did Rome need Constantine to Christianize the whole Roman Empire then? You know, now how was he Christian? Where did he learn Christian if he came from Britain? And I know they tried to obscure his parents and say, we don't really know where Helen was from. And, you know, his father was a Spanish general. You know, that's all BS. He clearly was raised in Britain, learned Christian from his mother, who is Britain. And Britain was Christian, and he wanted to bring that to the Roman Empire. That's what happened, right?
I mean, that's the only logical answer, isn't it? You know, and that makes sense rather than, oh, he just had a vision of a cross and it told him that in this sign you will conquer, and he then just defeated everyone and became the emperor and made Christianity the religion. Well, no, he was brought up a Christian in a country that had been Christian for 200 years. He was the king of that country, and obviously that was his tradition. And he brought that tradition to Rome. Patriarch, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, it's irrefutable that obviously Christianity was in Britain beforehand. Like you say, Constantine was Christian. But I just think that, you know, the power hub of the Roman Church obviously wanting to adopt Christianity and kind of repackage, rebrand it in a way that was more of a dominant force. So they was just swallowing anything else up, and that includes, you know, a retelling of history, you know, to pit them as the, you know, the central movement.
Yeah, it was a supranational sort of empire, wasn't it? I mean, at times it was useful, and it was useful to have this Commonwealth that we joined up with. But at other times it was interference in individual nations' political affairs that we didn't want, and that, you know, that was eventually led to the downfall of Roman Catholicism. Anglo-Saxon paganism only existed for a relatively short time span, from the 5th to the 8th centuries. Our knowledge of the Christianization process derives from Christian textual sources, as the pagans were illiterate. Both Latin and Ogham inscriptions and The Ruin of Britain by Gildas suggest that the leading families of Dumonia and other Brittonic kingdoms had already adopted Christianity in the 6th century. So they will admit that we had Christianity in the 6th century, but of course that's after Constantine appeared in Kent. And Gildas makes it quite clear that, you know, this is a Christian country, and the Britons are Christian. And as it says here, that this Anglo-Saxon paganism, it just existed for about 200 years, you know. So anybody British that claims to be following ancient British traditions by being a pagan, you know, they're just LARPing. You know, it was an invader's religion, and it only lasted for a couple of centuries, and all they had to show for it was some wooden sheds that they erected. You know, they didn't even put up stone circles or dolmens or anything like that. They just built some wooden sheds. So there we go. Let's move back on to Augustine after that detour there. Kent was probably chosen by Pope Gregory and Augustine because Ethelbert, that was the king in Kent, had married a Christian princess, Bertha, the daughter of Charibert I, the king of Paris, and that was one of the Frankish kings, one of the Merovingian kings that we've talked about. She was expected to exert some influence over her husband. Before reaching Kent, the missionaries had considered turning back. I mean, they did want to go back. They didn't want to continue. But Pope Gregory urged them on. And in 597, Augustine landed on the Isle of Thanet and proceeded to Ethelbert's main town of Canterbury. So this island, again, is so important in British history, isn't it? Augustine landed on the Isle of Thanet. You know, that's where Caesar landed, was on the Isle of Thanet. All sorts of things have happened around this particular part of Britain, the Isle of Thanet. I mean, we've drawn attention to it before. And also because Ethelbert's main town was Canterbury and Kent, that then became the archbishopric. And Augustine was made the Archbishop of Canterbury. This is why our tradition goes back to the chief bishop being the Archbishop of Canterbury. It goes back to Augustine. But before that, you know, we had Minerva, which is now St. David's, which is where Alfred the Great had to go to in order to get somebody to teach his men how to read and write in the 9th century. And we already had these places that actually had bishoprics that were sending bishops to these councils that were happening in Rome and Nicaea and all these other places. We already had bishoprics here in Britain. So basically what Augustine was doing was usurping the Christian traditions that had already been established in Britain and the Christian hierarchy and all the rest of it. I think that was more important to him than Christianizing the Saxons, I think, was getting the British church to obey Rome and say that their loyalty was then going to be to the Pope. And we've got a bit on the Pope, which we'll get into in a bit. Truefids, do you want to add anything to this?
Well, I think that Kent is just the easiest place to access, right? It's the southeast of England. That's why I think he went there, and it would be relatively isolated from, you know, it wasn't a war zone like the other, you know, boundaries of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms where they're constantly fighting the Britons. And, you know, if Augustine really cared, he would have traveled there and, you know, put his life on the line to spread Christianity and to try and bring peace to the island and stop the wars and to unite them. But you can see, as you said, his real ambition was to bring the British Isles under the sway of the Catholic Church. Really, you should just be happy to see your race becoming Christian, and then off you go build a great Christian civilization. Your job is done. It's not to rule over them, right?
Yeah, I think clearly he knew that he was going to get a friendly welcome in Kent because the wife of the queen of the king of Kent was Christian, and he was given a church there, and eventually he did convert King Ethelbert, patriarch. Any thoughts on this? And it's amazing the Isle of Thanet turns up in our history so many times, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a lot of wars fought there, weren't there, with the Romans. Yeah, it's obviously just a strategic point of entry. It might be, not sure, particularly of all of the coastlines, sort of Dover, Folkestone and whatnot, maybe in Hastings, maybe they were more heavily fortified initially rather than slightly around the other side. I don't know, but yeah, it's just got a lot of history and it's just a strategic hotspot.
Probably worth checking out if any of our listeners are down there in the southeast of the country. King Ethelbert converted to Christianity and allowed the missionaries to preach freely, giving them land to found a monastery outside the city walls. Augustine was consecrated as a bishop and converted many of the king's subjects, including thousands, during a mass baptism on Christmas Day in 597. Pope Gregory sent more missionaries in 601, along with encouraging letters and gifts for the churches, although attempts to persuade the native British bishops to submit to Augustine's authority failed. And we'll get into that in a bit. I mean, they try to make a big point here that he converted the king's subjects. Thousands were baptized on Christmas Day. But once the king had converted, all his subjects would get baptized as well. Once the king had done that, everybody else had to do it anyway. It wasn't that he went out and he evangelized to, you know, all the different people that were the king's subjects. It was just that he managed to convert the king. And once the king had converted, all the king's people obviously converted as well. And you think, I think that's just, you know, it's just common sense. So they're really trying to sort of make him out to be something that he isn't. And he didn't just not manage to persuade the British bishops to submit to his authority. He didn't manage to convert anyone else either. I mean, it was just Kent that remained converted. As I pointed out before, the other areas were Christianized by missionaries from Ireland and from Wales. They're called the Celtic Saints. Do you want to add anything to this, Truefids?
Yeah, Kent was like the smallest kingdom, right? So compared to like Wessex, Mercia, Northumbria, and the rest. So him, you know, he didn't really achieve much. And why would the British bishops submit to Augustine? Because Britain made Rome Christian. And then centuries later, Rome comes back and says, all right, well, now we're going to rule over you as Christians. And you'd be like, what? We made you Christian. It's a joke, right?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't want to submit to Rome. Rather insulting, isn't it? Patriarch, any thoughts?
No, not really. Not on this part.
Well, we can then move back to R.W. Morgan and what he has to say about Augustine's attempts to persuade the bishops. Augustine requested an interview with the bishops of the British Church. The Archbishop of Caerleon or St. David's deputed Dunwood, the Abbot of Bangor, and the Bishops of Hereford, Worcester, Bangor, St. Asaph, Llandaff, Llanbadarn, and Margam to meet him. So there we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 bishops. So there are already 9 bishops in Britain at this time. And Wikipedia is telling us that, you know, there was no Christianity here and the Britons were just following these, adding their polytheistic beliefs to the Saxon beliefs. 2 conferences were held under the protection of Brocvel, the Prince of Powys, on the confines of Herefordshire, or Ferrex, at a place called Augustine's Oak, which is now called Ostcliff, on the Severn. The second conference lasted 7 days. Dunwood and the British bishops disputed, states Leland, with great learning and gravity against the authority of Augustine. They maintained the jurisdiction of the Archbishopric of St. David's and affirmed that the ancient Britons would never acknowledge either Roman pretensions or Saxon usurpation. So, I mean, here we have this historian stating this as well. That they debated with great learning and gravity against Augustine. But again, Wikipedia wants to just ignore that. Once the conferences were closed by the British bishops, they delivered on behalf of the British church and people the following rejection of the papal claims, which is the oldest as well as the most dignified national protest on record. Be it known and declared to you that we all, individually and collectively, are in all humility prepared to defer to the Church of God and to the Pope of Rome and to every sincere and godly Christian so far as to love everyone according to his degree in perfect charity and to assist them all by word and deed in becoming the children of God. But as for further obedience, we know of none that he whom you term the Pope or Bishop of Bishops can claim or demand. The deference which we have mentioned we are ever ready to pay to him, as to every other Christian. But in all other respects, our obedience is due to the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Caerleon, who is alone under God, our ruler, to keep us right in the way of salvation. The British Church, remarks Sir Henry Spelman, acknowledged no superior to its Archbishop of Caerleon or St. David's, but God alone. It knew nothing of the jurisdiction of any foreign power or potentate. So, I mean, they already had a church and they already had their superior and they didn't want to go following the Roman church. And the reason, one of these reasons why they didn't accept Augustine is because he didn't appear to have any manners. I think we'll probably get into this a little bit more later on, but basically when the bishops were on their way to the church, they went to a holy man and they said, what should we do here? And the holy man said, well, if Augustine rises to greet you when you meet him, then that shows that he is an equal and he's genuine. But if he just remains seated and snubs you like that, then you should ignore what he says. And when the British bishops went to see Augustine, he didn't rise to greet them. So he didn't extend them the common courtesy that civilized people should extend. Which, again, which just shows you how civilized and chivalrous people were back then and how important it was to show common courtesy. So that was the reason, you know, why they were turned against him. But also, I mean, as they point out here, there was nothing to say that they should bow down to the Pope of Rome, basically. So this shows that this was a new idea, this Bishop of Bishops. Trufids, any thoughts on the British bishop's response here?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think everything they say is very reasonable. I can't see anything wrong with that. I think also the way Augustine, you know, kind of pretended he was coming to convert Anglo-Saxons, but really he had ulterior motives, that would rub people the wrong way, right? If it had just been honest right at the start and just said, look, we're trying to unite Christianity under one, maybe they would have heard him a bit better. But the way he's sneakily, you know, came to say, I'm helping you, but actually I want to rule over you. You know, there's no reason why any bishop should rule over another country, right? It's different if like a king of England says, you know, I'm raising an army to defend our country and I need you to pay some tax to maintain this army, or I need men. It's unfair if I'm fighting and you over in one corner of the country aren't contributing to defend our nation. That's a very different thing. But for a pope to demand all Christians bow to him because he's the bishop of bishop, you know, there's no the jurisdiction for that, right?
No, I mean, I think you want to have like a structure there in the church and with a hierarchy and with learned people that can make decisions on things, you know, sort of like you would have a court of law and you would go to a court to get a decision on something and learned men would decide it and then the judge would make his decision. And I think you needed something similar like that with the church. But the problem was that isn't really what you had here. What you had here was somebody who almost had the same amount of power as the national king. Because it does make sense that you have to have somebody that can preside over these decisions. But what the British church were used to doing was going to Constantinople for these decisions. They weren't used to going to Rome. And this pope was a new idea. This is why we say that the British were Anglo-Orthodox rather than being Roman Catholic. And of course, they're going to have more loyalty to Constantinople because it was founded by their own King Constantine. I mean, even in Wales, you've got places that are called Constantinople after Constantine. And as we'll see as we go through these histories, I mean, there were quite a few people that were named Constantine after Constantine. You know, lots of people were actually named by that name. So that shows you that, you know, our history here in Britain, just by the fact that we've got places that are also called Constantinople. I don't think we've got anywhere that's called Rome, because we were against Rome. Patriarch, any thoughts on the British bishop's response here?
Yeah, he's obviously spot on with what he's saying. And, you know, obviously it's, I think that level of structure and control power within a church structure can only kind of corrupt and pave way for corruption and distortion of the true message, really, which I think is what happened. And obviously it's essentially the Catholic Church, isn't it, or the Roman Catholic, so to speak, and I think you know, when it obviously amassed a certain amount of power, it, like any power hungry entity, it wants more, and that often comes at the cost, you know, the integrity of the core message and who it was for, really. And obviously we know what happened after it kind of branched out and opened the gates. in order to gain more power. So yeah, it was clearly something that he, you know, was skeptical of, and for good reason.
Well, we have some notes here that Truthvids has written for us, giving us some more information about the Pope here, because we haven't really talked about the Pope yet. The popes used the pagan title Pontifex Maximus. This translated literally means the highest bridge builder. By bridge builder, it means bridge between God and this world. The popes, therefore, claimed that they were the bridge between man and God. In other words, to get to heaven, you had to go through the Pope, not through Christ. This title had its origins in ancient pagan Rome and was a pagan title that goes as far back in history as the legendary Aeneas arriving in Italy. When Troy was sacked, a remnant fled away, led under Aeneas, a prince of the Trojans and the grandfather of Brutus. They settled in Latium in Italy, and Aeneas married the daughter of the king of the Latium people. Soon after, the king of Latium died, and Aeneas became the king of both the Latium people and his Trojans. Aeneas's wife gave birth to a son, Silvius. However, there was a dilemma, as Aeneas already had a son from his previous wife in Troy, who he had brought with him. This son was called Ascanius, but also was known as Julus. Which son would become the ruler over both people after Aeneas? To solve this dilemma, Silvius inherited the kingship and Julus inherited the priesthood, and this priesthood was known as the Pontifex Maximus. Many centuries later, Julius Caesar, who came to rule over the Roman Empire, had inherited the priesthood title, the Pontifex Maximus, as the Julius line claimed to be direct descendants from Julius. Eventually, his successor, Octavian, his nephew, gained the Roman Empire and also the title of Pontifex Maximus. The emperors were thus the rulers and the priests of the entire empire. Therefore, after Rome fell and the Bishop of Rome gradually rose in stature, he gained the title of Pope. They revived this pagan title of Pontifex Maximus and merged it into Christianity. But as we can see, it has no origin at all from within Christianity. So it implies, by the time Julius Caesar had it, I guess it implies that the priest of the empire is also the ruler of the empire. So it's really sort of giving the head of the Roman church, or the priest of the Roman church, rather more than he should have actually had, I think. Do you want to add to this, Truthvids?
Yeah, if you want to control an empire, you have to control the religion, right? The thoughts and minds of the people. So you have to be a ruler, and either you are the priest, or, you know, usually kings would be very closely associated with, you know, the temples and the priesthoods, and they would do deals and make sure that they kept each other in power. And that's how they ruled the empire. And here we have essentially the Pope using this Roman title to rule over Christendom, right? And, you know, there are many other aspects brought into Christianity. Like you mentioned, the Trinity. I believe the origin was in the Greek philosophies that were springing up in the mind, and to bring all, you know, the Greeks into Christianity, they brought that in as well, and that satisfied them. And then you had, you know, people had temples to Apollo and this god and that god, and they said, look, you can stay the priest and keep your temple, but instead of Apollo, now it's Saint Peter, and instead of this god, it's Saint Paul. So you see a lot of pagans, they wanted to maintain their power, so they, you know, tried to change the paganism into Christianity, essentially. And then a lot of those religions, they had the Queen of Heaven. That's really down to those pagan religions that believed the great serpent of heaven. Sometimes it was androgynous, but sometimes it was seen as this great female who created all the races and all the people, and that was the Queen of Heaven. And they found, aha, look, Christ was born by a virgin. We'll make Mary the Queen of Heaven. So now we can still worship that, but you can also be Christian. So they brought all these kind of ideas and solidified it in Catholicism, right?
Yeah, I think also the ancient Hebrews, I mean, their priesthood was the Levitical priesthood, and it was from one particular tribe, and they couldn't be kings. You know, they couldn't rule. They were specifically meant to be priests. And it was the same thing with Druidry. You had the Druids, and that was hereditary. And they were the priests, and they had a specific role. And the king was separate to it. But then you have this Roman idea where the priest is also the ruler. And then that makes its way into Christianity. So I think, you know, this idea of hereditary priests and they can only be priests, that prevents that from happening. And I think, didn't they say that Jesus was both a king and a priest? He was the only one? Something like in the line of Melchizedek. Am I getting that right there, Truthfords?
Yeah, the Melchizedek priesthood, that was passed on from Adam to Seth, et cetera, to Noah, to Shem. And then I think 1600 years later, Abraham's there and he gives tithes to the Melchizedek priesthood, but we don't know who it was by then. And then it kind of disappears. But since Christ is God, then he's the original Melchizedek priesthood, because Adam, it would have inherited it from him. And since the priesthood disappeared, well, he's the original. So he's the priest, but he's also the king, but only the king of, you know, through Judah, through David. He's the king of all the Israelites, right? And of course, God of the world, basically.
So he's only Christ is both king and priest. You're supposed to have a separate priestly line and a separate kingly line. Patriarch, any thoughts on this, on the Pope or the Roman Catholic Church?
Yeah, obviously we know that it became a corruption of the original message. But it's also hard to deny the good that it had been brought to Europe through that as well. You know, like, a lot of the papacy, under the control of the papacy, there was, you know, a lot of wealth brought to the nations and a lot of success. So it's almost like, you know, at the top echelons of power, you've got this corruption and evil, but, you know, at the societal level, you know, you've got people that are kind of ruled by fear and actually doing the workings of Christianity, and, you know, being good to each other and I guess bearing fruit that helps to build the nation. So it's I wouldn't say it's all kind of a bad thing. It's just the intricacies of how God works. You know, but we're here today now where we're at the tether end of, you know, a falling society.
Yeah, I think you make a good point there. We should stress that, you know, the Catholic Church was also responsible for lots of good things. And I mean, we wouldn't have the Bibles today if they hadn't kept, you know, writing it out, writing the traditions. And it was the Roman Catholic Church that stood against Freemasonry right up to the 18th and 19th century. And there were two factions within it. There was a traditionalist faction and a liberal faction. And a lot of the Axis powers like Germany, Italy, various other ones, they were run by Catholics. And it was a Catholic resistance against communism and Bolshevism and also Freemasonry. So you did have a lot of good came from within the Catholic Church, but you also had this corruption there. And I think this idea of the Pope ties in with that, and also this absorbing of these different beliefs. And I think Apollo got turned into Saint Michael. You know, a lot of these angels that we have in the Roman Catholic Church can be traced back to these sort of pagan ideas. And you didn't actually have a Roman Catholic Church until the schism, which took place in, I think, 1060, something like that. And that was when the power of the Pope just got too much. And the eastern part of the church said, right, well, we're going to split. And they became the Eastern Orthodox Church. And the Western Church became the Roman Catholic Church. And up to that point, you had, before that, you just had, I guess you could call it Catholicism. There is a word for it, named after one of the councils, Chalcedon. Something like that, the Chalcedonian Church, not quite sure which. But there was a united church up until 1060. Then there was this schism because the Pope's influence had just become too much. And that's why that now today you have the Eastern Orthodox Church and you have the Roman Catholic Church. And the Roman Catholic Church wasn't really called Roman Catholicism until this split in uh, in 1060. I think we should probably leave that for here today, and we'll continue with Augustine in the next episode. So thank you very much for coming on today, Truthfeeds.
Thanks for having me, as always, Ben.
Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriot.
Thanks, Ben. Good, another good podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.